As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
The race is on, and the driver market merry-go-round has been whirring frantically this week, with Sebastian Vettel's divorce from Ferrari leading to Carlos Sainz being signed to replace him, and Daniel Ricciardo slotting into the vacancy at McLaren. And there will be more deals to come. I'm Ed Shaw, and there's no surprises in my guest lineup because we've retained the services of Mark Hughes and Scott Mitchell. Mark, amid all this, has the old typing finger been working furiously on the typewriter with everything that's been going on?
It has. It's been a blur. Yeah, some of the characters are getting rubbed off the keys, actually, yeah.
I'm going to try and bring to life your typing style, because you kind of type in the style of someone pointing furiously but very rapidly.
Yeah, I don't see what the problem is with that. It's, if you're talking about a critical path analysis, it's not the typing speed that determines how long it takes to write a feature, is it? It's the thinking speed.
Well, depends who you're talking about. I tend to just, as long as there's 1,000 words that are real words, that'll do me.
Yeah, well, it's getting them in the right order and things, isn't it, really?
That is indeed the trick. And another person who has been hammering stuff out frantically on a keyboard is Scott Mitchell. Always fun when all this happens, isn't it?
Yeah, I don't even worry about making sure they're real words. I'd just start pounding the keyboard and then just send it. It's the sub's job to make me look good, so...
Yeah, that's fair, and they do a very, very good job, because some of your stuff, in its final form, it looks very good, and people would actually
think... It's borderline legible, isn't it?
It's actually genuinely good, yeah, and because of that, there's loads of stuff on the race website, so that's therace.com, and don't forget the hyphen. Loads of different angles, some of which we'll delve into on this podcast. We've covered Vettel leaving Ferrari in our previous podcast. There's lots about him there. But we're really going to focus on the Sainz deal and the Ricciardo deal and the knock-on effects of that. So let's start with Carlos Sainz, Scott. A sensible move. There's very few people saying that this is a mad choice, even if Daniel Ricciardo was seen as the favourite.
Yeah, I think it's... I think you basically split sort of Carlos Sainz... The response to Sainz's appointment down the middle, because the people in his corner recognise the job that he's done, particularly last year. You can see the gains he's made as a racing driver. But the detractors will not unfairly point to the fact that he has often been slightly unspectacular. And I think that's more a legacy of him going under the radar than it is a reflection of his true ability. But if someone has followed Sainz's full career, he has always been a slightly below spectacular talent. If you look at, I think in Formula Renault, he won the Northern European Cup and was second to, was it Robin Freins in Euro Cup. So that in itself there, he marks himself out really early on as well as being the son of the legend that is Carlos Sr. He's in his own rights, he's looking like a really good talent. But then he was a bit sort of mediocre, wasn't he, in Formula 3 and GP3. He was a race winner, and I'm not trying to make out like he was a no-hoper or anything like that, but it was when he got into 3.5 that he suddenly emerged as the... It was almost like all that potential finally started to come together, and I quite like the symmetry between... He got his F1 chance because Vettel left Red Bull and wanted to join Ferrari, and now he's got his... second big F1 break because Vettel's leaving Ferrari and Carlos is going there to replace him. But a lot has happened in the meantime. And I think depending on how much you've paid attention to Sainz's five seasons in F1 determines whether you think this is a good decision or a bad decision.
Yeah, it's funny how these things work. I imagine Sebastian Vettel will be on Carlos Sainz's Christmas card list for the rest of time. But Mark, when it comes to this, I mean, it's clear that Ferrari have gone to Sainz because they think he's going to be kind of a good partner for Charles Leclerc. I did a piece on the race website saying that Ferrari might not quite be getting what they bargained for, even though he's a really good choice. What do you think of the mindset that led to Ferrari taking Sainz? And would you agree maybe it's not necessarily the easy option that perhaps some think it is?
On that latter point, yes, I'd agree. Somewhere down the line, I think there will still be some awkward moments on the Ferrari pit wall. But that's a bridge to cross when they come to it. In terms of why they signed Carlos rather than the perhaps from the outside more obvious Daniel Ricciardo, who's a proven race winner, I think it was largely the fact that at the respective stages in their careers, Ricciardo's 5 years older, absolutely bursting to win a world championship before the clock ticks down. He's 31 years old, I think 31. And has already proven himself to be a race winner. So he's going to be coming in there full of ambition and desire to win sooner rather than later. Carlos is in an earlier part of his career, has yet to have the opportunity of a top car in which to win races, and is going to be more able to slot into the role that Ferrari envisage. So I think the problem with signing Daniel for them is that Leclerc is effectively their chosen one going forward for the next few years. And putting Daniel in there was potentially just giving them the exact same problem that they had with Seb, which was that as a proven winner, he wasn't prepared to be in that role. And I don't think Daniel would have been either. And so I think Carlos, he's not going there as an outright number two. I'm sure the terms will be very similar to those that we used to see in the Vettel Raikkonen days when Vettel was the number one. You saw a few races where when Kimi was able to set pole position or be out of reach at the undercut, etc., he was still allowed to fight for the win. But the emphasis was very much on Seb, just as it will be very much on Charles. But it's now down to Carlos to, you know, find a way through that and see, you know, what opportunities present themselves.
Well, that's exactly the thing, though, isn't it? Status, yes, you carry that into the team with you, but that becomes much less important once the actual on-track stuff starts, and always performance will define who's the favoured driver, who's the stronger driver. And no doubt, I mean, Carlos may be earlier in his career than someone like Ricciardo, but we can't doubt, can we, that he goes in there thinking, right, I'm going to get this team behind me. It doesn't mean he's going to actively create a massive schism, but, you know, he's a good enough driver to cause problems. And it just feels like, although, yes, Ricciardo is the slightly higher stage, is the highest status driver, and Ricciardo is the more rounded driver at this stage. I don't think there's as big a gap between Ricciardo and Sainz, perhaps as some make out. So I think it's a good signing, but there's potential for there to be problems there. What do you make of it, Scott?
Yeah, I think I'm of the opinion that Sainz is the less disruptive option. I think Mark has a much better way of phrasing that. When we were putting together sort of the list of reasons why Sainz is the right choice for Ferrari, if you look at how appropriate he is the best way to describe it. I think, you know, you and I have slightly different views of exactly where Sainz's level is compared to Ricciardo. I think Ricciardo is just enough of a step ahead of Sainz that he would have caused Leclerc more trouble from the get-go. But I really rate Carlos, and I think even if it's a more harmonious relationship or more harmonious atmosphere in the early months or the early stages, Sainz is absolutely good enough to cause Leclerc trouble, but it depends how much Leclerc gets his feet under the table, whether or not this is a relationship whereby Sainz falls into that Kimi role where Ferrari conveniently forgets about him because they're focusing on Leclerc. I don't think this version of Ferrari will do that. I think they recognise the need for two well-performing drivers, and I think that creates an environment where Sainz can show what he's made of.
I think it's normally better for a team to have two strong drivers. So actually, I don't necessarily think it's a bad thing. But, you know, Sainz, in terms of not causing disruption, etc., you know, he's a very professional in the way he works. But we should remember Toro Rosso, when it was him and Verstappen, that got intensely political. Yes, there were lots of players involved in that, but Sainz was part of it. Also, the way Sainz manoeuvred himself out of Red Bull wound Red Bull up a little bit. So, you know, Sainz is, he knows, I mean, he's his father's son, isn't he? Carlos Sr. has a very good understanding of how to play the political game and how to get teams behind him and how to best out of himself. That's not a bad thing. That's a good thing for a driver in motorsport. But I don't really see, even if Ricciardo has a better platform through his status, I'm not sure that other than that initial automatic impact, Ricciardo and Sainz are necessarily that different in terms of the potential disruption that may be caused, the kind of disruption that always follows when you have two decent drivers. Having said that, probably the big difference is that Sainz is not necessarily quite as strong qualifier as Leclerc is. And also, we have seen him struggle a little bit when there's a bit of rear instability. I think that's quite an interesting comparison to where Vettel was at times last year. So maybe that car dynamics element of it, I think, could play a part in whether Sainz is going to be significantly problematic initially, or whether he will be that effective number two. How do you see the kind of comparisons of those two, Mark, in terms of that they're kind of operating windows? I'd definitely say Leclerc's just a little bit more broad overall, even though Sainz has improved in that regard.
Yeah, I'd probably agree that Leclerc's slightly broader range is more able to keep momentum with a bit of a rear instability. But I don't think Carlos is the has as narrow a window actually as Seb. Seb was always looking for something very, very specific from the car. And when he got it, it was dynamite. I don't think Carlos is quite that narrow in range, but he's this. If Carlos can develop the car that to the way he likes it, that will be a faster car than it would have been. It was interesting early last year, when Alonso came back to test the McLaren, I think it was a Bahrain. So he was no longer racing it, but he came back to give them a second opinion on the car. And I was asking Carlos, did he say the same sort of things you were saying? And he said, no, actually. He said he was saying it's better, but it's still got too much rear instability. And I said, no, for me, It's fine like that. At least you can get it into the corners. He said, if you want to see what rear instability was like, you should have driven my Renault last year. And he was actually after a more responsive car than Alonso. So I think he's somewhere in that. I think he's in towards that end, but probably not as quite as adept as Charles at dealing with an unstable car.
Yeah, so it'd be interesting to see how the car characteristics shake out. But the upshot is, though, Scott, that Ferrari have got a very good driver lineup here, haven't they? That's two drivers. We know Leclerc can win races. Sainz has executed some brilliant races in his time. He's always had a good knack for that. I guess most recently, you could look at Interlagos last year, where he started at the back. He kind of did a bit of everything in that race, a bit of overtaking, and then late on very old tyres, it was a minor miracle he managed to hold position at that final restart. So they've got people in the cars who can deliver consistent, strong points. So if the car's up to it, we will see world championship challenges on both fronts, won't we?
Yeah, and I think someone like Sainz, who has been in that sort of midfield dogfight, and he's, you're right, executed all sorts of races. He's won Class B from pole position. He's absolutely obliterated his opposition in that battle. He's had to fight back from adversity. So he's well placed to take advantage of this, because while the pressure, especially when you're driving for a team like Ferrari, is so high, especially when you're fighting for wins and outright wins, and you're responsible for a championship bid, that is a different test altogether. But there is something to be said for being lifted out of the maelstrom of the midfield, and in some ways that will be easier. He will have fewer cars to focus on at the front of the field. He will have fewer variables at play. He will have a better car underneath him. He'll have a better team on the pit wall, in theory. He'll have a better team in the garage. So he will have more of what he needs, in theory, to get the most out of himself. And one of Sainz's biggest assets, I think, is his absolute determination to self-improvement. He's absolutely like Leclerc in this regard. He's a very, very positive. I know what you were saying earlier about the Toro Rosso environment, but as you said, he's Carlos Jr. by actions as well as name, isn't he? He knows what it means to get the team on your side. So I think he's got everything he needs to build on what he did in the midfield. And he's got a podium rate of, what is it, like 1 in 102? I think he's had a 102 starts. That's obviously not reflective of his ability. And if the Ferrari is competitive from the get-go in 2021, I really don't think it'll be very long before Sainz is putting in the sort of race performances that reward him with his first podiums and ultimately his first win.
Yeah, it'd be nice for him to actually get onto a podium at the right time this time, because obviously he was promoted into it at Interlagos. But obviously, there were strong candidates for this drive. I mean, we said, Scott, on a previous podcast, I mean, I certainly said that I'd probably just take Ricciardo over Sainz, so I still probably would have done, although it doesn't mean that one's a great signing, the other's a bad signing. I think they're still, as I said, still in sort of similar territory. What do you think, Mark? Would you have gone for Ricciardo if it was completely your choice and your team?
I don't think I would have been that disappointed either way. It would probably have been decided more on what my budgets were and stuff like that. So given the dynamic there, and given that Ferrari see their Leclerc as their future, I can perfectly understand their signing of Carlos. But as you say, I think that doesn't mean that Carlos won't be able to form his own corner there and look after himself and ultimately win races there.
Yeah, I think that's a fair way of looking at it. It's basically you've got a choice of two and you've got two very, very good outcomes. And I do think you touched on it, Scott. Sainz has constantly improved himself, which is always a very good example of what makes a good driver. I do think as well that those sequence of teams he's been through, going from Toro Rosso, then to Renault, then to McLaren. When he moved to Renault, he was surprised by how big a jump it was and how much there was to learn, understanding how to use all the different tools, the diff settings, all these things. And that meant that when he moved to McLaren, he was a bit more prepared for that. So he really thought, right, I'm going to go and I'm going to embed myself with the team. So I'm going to understand how everything works, understand how the people works. And then that meant that he got to the start of the season knowing as well as he could, without having raced the car, how everything worked, who everything was. The team loved him. Everything fitted together. And I think that's something he'll look to repeat with Ferrari. Of course, he's an Italian speaker as well, which does make a difference, not just for his commercial appeal for an Italian team. And we should also say he's very, very polished off track, probably more polished than Ricciardo, who's a big character, but a little bit more rough around the edges, shall we say. So that probably played a part. But I think we'll see Sainz do everything he can to mean he can hit the ground running at the start of 21, won't we?
Yeah, I think Carlos is just going to endear himself in every way, isn't he? He's going to put his best foot forward. And you mentioned that sort of apprenticeship that he's had in Formula One. That sequence of teams worked quite well for Alonso, didn't it? Carlos is going down exactly the same route. Minardi / Toro Rosso, then obviously onto Renault, McLaren, now Ferrari. Hopefully, Sainz is obviously going to hope that it goes a little bit better.
Yeah, it's ever increasing disappointment that path leads you on, isn't it?
It is, but the trick is to basically not alienate people along the way. And I think there's also Carlos hasn't had to go back to Renault in between or anything like that, has he? So I think it's a little bit like, because obviously with Sainz and Alonso, there has been that sort of like mentor relationship, and it must be quite useful for someone like Junior, because if you look at someone like Max Verstappen, big part of his education, we've talked about this on a podcast before, was Jos basically teaching Max all the mistakes you make in a racing career and then don't make them. And that's one of the reasons why Max's development has been so rapid. And then I guess from a Sainz point of view, with someone like Alonso, you've got a guy who is available for when they're racing together in F1, and then when they were sort of colleagues at McLaren when Alonso was still an ambassador, and even now when they're just sort of, they've got a personal relationship outside of their career. That's not a bad, I'm not saying that Alonso has made this possible by any stretch of the imagination, but it's not a bad person to be able to lean on, is it?
Yeah, definitely. It's all about learning, isn't it? That's what it's about. Should we move a little bit on to Daniel Ricciardo? We've touched on him. Obviously, in his mind, he was going to be the one at Ferrari. He got one tick in the list of boxes with Ferrari having a vacancy, but he's not ended up in the drive, which I guess if the Daniel Ricciardo that signed for Renault in the middle of 2018 was looking at how it would have worked out, and he ended up with what is effectively a sideways mover, I think McLaren is a better place to be than Renault, he'd have been a bit disappointed. This master plan hasn't quite worked for Ricciardo, but he is still in the game with this move, isn't he?
Yes, and I mean, in hindsight, jumping from the Red Bull to the Renault was only going to work if Renault ended up as a race-winning potential car in quite short order, 3 years, maybe two, three seasons, and it's quite clear that that's not going to be the case. So, I think he's now better placed to stay in the game. I think McLaren has got, with the Mercedes engines on the way, and it's steadily improving technical core, I think you can see a clearer progression in competitiveness there than you, when you look at Renault, you say, well, why is it going to make that jump? What are the reasons that you could believe that it's going to make that jump? And really, it doesn't make such an obvious case for itself as McLaren does. And I think the delaying of the new regulations to 22 from 21 is probably a little bit of a setback, and that would have been a nice clean sheet for everyone. And I think that would probably have helped McLaren more. But I think they still will be in a stronger position than Renault for Daniel to A, put himself in position and make it obvious that he's still got what it takes, and two, for that team itself to become a race-winning proposition.
I think that McLaren has effectively sort of moved into the position that Renault was in a couple of years ago, hasn't it? It's like positioned itself as not just best of the rest, but best place to make the step. And that will have been what concerned Ricciardo so much was... He had talks with McLaren. Zak Brown said a couple of years ago, didn't he, that they were really close to getting him when Ricciardo was leaving Red Bull. But ultimately, Renault was a better competitive proposition at the time. And it's a testament to not only the positives of McLaren and the efforts they've made and the improvements they've made, but it's also testament to the problems at Renault, that the works team hasn't been able to continue that momentum and they've been overtaken by their engine customer. And I think that Ricciardo's basically looked at that and just decided that it's better to make a sort of sideways step and half a step forward than it is continue backing the Renault horse, because we shouldn't forget that Ricciardo's not driven the 2020 car in anger. He's only done testing and they were cautiously optimistic, but he's made this decision without going racing in the 2020 car, the car that Cyril Abitbol was hoping would convince Ricciardo early on would be good enough to prove that they're capable of making the steps that they need to. So it's a big, it says a lot about how much confidence Ricciardo has in what Renault is doing at the moment and wants to do in the near future.
It's funny, isn't it, to think how the situation this year might have impacted things. We knew it was going to have an impact, but you know, somewhere there's a universe where there's no COVID-19 and Sebastian Vettel's maybe torn it up in the first half of the season and gets a new deal. Renault takes a big step forward and Ricciardo's convinced he's going to be mega and everything changes. So we'll never really be able to judge how different things would have been, because certainly in Vettel's case, it changes the game completely. The fact that he's going to start the season when it gets going, knowing he's out of the car. But it is a funny thing for Ricciardo, because you know he's a man in a hurry. He's spoken over a few years now about being aware that the clock is ticking. You know, he's still got quite a few years ahead of him, but he knows he needs to get into a world championship car before it's too late. And he's basically managed to go in a situation where he's got 2 years older, effectively, and he's made a move to the best placed midfield team in 2018 for the 2019 season. And now he's moving across to the best placed upwardly mobile midfield team for 2021. I think it's absolutely the right move to go to McLaren. It's interesting. I think it does tell us a lot about where Renault is at, because yes, we know there's all of the question marks about Renault's commitment, etc. There's still commercial things to be agreed for them to continue. We don't know what the budget level is going to be like, etc., etc. But I think if Ricciardo was, who will know vast amounts about what's going on in the team and what the potential is, if it was really that great potential and it was on that upward trajectory that we'd expect of a manufacturer team, he might well have thought, well, I may as well stay for a bit. So that's interesting. And I could imagine if you're confronted by what McLaren are doing and what Renault are doing, you know, McLaren are being very strategic. I think Andreas Seidel's a great team principal. He understands how to run a racing team. He talks sense. He's got that sort of quiet authority of someone who has a plan and isn't afraid to take long-term strategic decisions rather than panicking about making himself look good in the short term. So things like the Mercedes engine deal, things like the wind tunnel. And you can imagine Ricciardo having this all run past him, and he'd think, yeah, this all absolutely makes sense. But at the same time, Mark, we know it probably means the earliest Ricciardo's got a chance of getting into a race-winning car again is 2022. And that's if, assuming he's still at McLaren, then if McLaren is able to make a big step forward, because it doesn't look like they've done it with this year's car. There's no reason to expect that the continuation car next year will do that, even though there may be a bit of a bump from the Mercedes engine. So, yeah, it's now, what's that? That's about 4 years this has cost Ricciardo of being in a race-winning car now.
Yes, and I mean, even though McLaren is making progress, it was still, even as head of Class B, if you like, it was still over a second adrift of the front. So it was many races getting lapped. So that doesn't, you don't claw that back in with one car, with one iteration. So that's what I was referencing earlier when I said the delay of the new regs is, while it's helpful to everybody in terms of the budgets, it's not helpful to the smaller teams that would have got a bit of a competitive reset. So the build-up advantages of the top three teams would be neutralized and everybody'd have to start again from scratch with a completely new set of technical regs. So, yes, it's a race against time for Daniel in terms of getting himself into a potential title-winning position. He's, I think, clearly good enough to contend for a title. I think he showed that at Red Bull. But whether he will ever get that opportunity at the moment, you would say the odds are less. You'd say the odds are against him, but it's not impossible, but you would say the odds are against him. So, yeah, it's very much ticking down, and Daniel sees it that way as well.
Yeah, ultimately, he's 31 in a few months, so while he's not a young driver anymore, he's still got a good 5, 6, 7, 8 years if he wants it. So there is still time. But yeah, he sent himself on a quite convoluted trajectory with this one. But I'd really like to see Ricciardo have a shot at the championship. I think he was probably, I rated him as the best performer of F1 in 2014. And you can make a good compelling case that he was the best driver in 2016 as well. So this is a very high-class driver, so I think we want to see that. Scott, how do you see the way he'll slot in alongside Lando Norris? Because I think that's, I mean, I'm already quite interested to see how Sainz versus Norris goes this year, and I'm even more interested to see how Ricciardo versus a third-year Norris goes next year.
Yeah, well, just look at the time it took Ricciardo to really get on terms with the Renault last year. It was difficult for him to really go in there and make his mark against Nico Hülkenberg. I know that Hülkenberg was obviously much more experienced than Lando is now and will be in at the start of 2021. But it shows that no matter how good you are as a driver, there are always challenges to overcome when you move to a new team. And by then, okay, Lando might not have many extra starts to his name by the time 21 starts, but he will have another year inside the team. He'll be he'll have his feet under the table. He'll know how it works. This car's designed around what Lando wants and what Sainz wants, not what Ricciardo wants. So, and it's not just about Lando being comfortable either. He's also a really, really, really talented driver. He's extremely fast. However impressive we view Sainz's 2019 season, he only just about had the edge on Lando for pace, and it was his experience on race days really that made a big difference over the course of the season. But Lando was also a pretty exceptional rookie in 2019. So the more he gets experience in Formula One, the more races he does, the more polished he'll be. And by the time Ricciardo arrives there, he will not be an easy person to brush aside. So maybe if you look at it optimistically, you could just say that Ricciardo's definitely going to be kept on his toes. He might be waiting a little while for his title bid. But with a guy like Lando in the other car, he's certainly going to have a challenge on his hand in the meantime. So he should be nice and sharp if and when that title shot ever actually arrives.
Yeah, it's easy to undervalue what Norris did last year in his rookie season. If you look at the points table, it looks like a fairly comprehensive victory for Sainz, who had 96 points to Norris's 49. But Norris probably had more bad luck than most drivers. He lost some big results. They both had some misfortune, in fairness. But I don't think that helped Lando Norris a great deal. And if you look at the qualifying comparison, I always keep track of a kind of adjusted qualifying comparison, so it removes anomalies and tries to compare like with like. And I think it was 10-9 in Norris's favour. And I think the feeling in the team, and this is probably why they're fairly not happy, but content to be trading Sainz for Ricciardo effectively, is that Norris, they feel, probably does have the greater underlying pace than Sainz. So potentially McLaren has lost its lead driver in terms of results, but actually they've still got the one that they think's probably got the greater ultimate potential, and they've brought in a great driver along them. So, Mark, if you're McLaren, you're relatively happy with this situation, aren't you?
Yeah, and I think I'd be very, very relieved that losing someone in the caliber of Carlos, that there was a ready-made replacement on the market in Daniel. So, yeah, I would be fairly relaxed about, it's a shame on a personal level, because they did gel very, very well, Carlos and the whole team and that driver pairing as well. But I think Daniel will slot in there very well too. So you're getting a known level of performance, a guaranteed level of performance, and some money that can slot in. So yeah, it could have been far worse for McLaren.
Well, given Scott Mitchell has moved to the edge of the frame on the communications device we're using to connect up, I can just see his Sweden football shirt shoulder sort of creeping into the frame. Well, to myself, but Mark, could you, or would you like to make a case to say that McLaren should have signed Sebastian Vettel, who was linked with the team and available? Personally, I think Ricciardo was the choice I'd have made. Vettel would bring a lot of qualities to the team. So do you think they should have gone for him instead?
No, I don't think I would have gone for him instead. I mean, Seb's obviously a world-class driver still with a searing turn of pace. You saw that in the latter half of last year as he sort of came back against Charles, who'd established the momentum, and he came back at him. So he still has the raw performance within him. But if I was in McLaren's position, I would be concerned that his motivation might not be as high as Daniel's. Daniel's still on that upward trajectory as far as his career is concerned. He's still got it all to do, whereas Seb's sort of coming down off the plateau, isn't he? He's coming down off having won four titles. And not being able to repeat it at Ferrari. So you would be going from a race-winning car to probably a car that's not race-winning yet. So, yeah, I would question why Seb would be we'd be doing it if I was McLaren, whereas Daniel, I could understand where the motivation was coming from. So no, I if I'd been McLaren, I would have been happier signing Daniel.
And after my absolutely seamless transition to trying to make sure my iPad didn't die and find a charger and plug it in, I will also contribute to this question and say I agree completely with Mark. I just think between the two of them, you've probably got similar pros, but maybe even more on Ricciardo's side because he is sort of entering his peak, whereas Vettel has sort of been struggling a little bit the last couple of years. And the cons aren't quite there either. So you do have to ask what this means for Vettel's F1 career now, because that was his... McLaren seemed the sort of logical move, and Renault, I guess, is an option, or your favoured punt, Ed, Racing Point / Aston Martin. But there are question marks now over Vettel's only remaining options to stay in Formula One.
Well, you're kind of trying to take command of what I've got to ask people now by saying you do have to ask about Vettel, but I do. And of course, we talked about him a lot on our previous podcast. We haven't really heard so much from Mark about this. So opening it up a little bit now, what would you be doing if you were Vettel? What, I mean, these are all different questions. What would you be doing? What do you think Vettel's thinking? And do you think Vettel will be able to find anything that would suit the ambitions he does have, should he want to stay in Formula One?
I think Seb would find it very, very hard to be motivated to be battling among the midfield. You know, even if you come out of the weekend knowing that you've done the absolute maximum with that car possible and all you've done is get lapped and finish sixth or seventh, it's not going to do it for someone that's achieved what he has. I really don't think that his stage in his career, he could get himself in the right frame of mind to make that acceptable long term. So if, on the other hand, he could somehow get himself into the Mercedes in place of Valtteri Bottas, or even a Red Bull reprise alongside Max, at least you would be in a potentially race-winning car. And I can imagine he would be motivated to the challenge of that. It'd be an enormous challenge measuring up to either Lewis Hamilton or Max Verstappen. But I don't think he would be shy of taking that challenge on. Whereas I really don't think he would be able to find from within himself the necessary commitment to a midfield drive.
Yeah, I think what you said there makes a lot of sense. I must admit, I don't think Mercedes or Red Bull, you can never say never, I don't think either of them are going to be signing Vettel. I'd quite like to see him go to a midfield team, which is hence the Racing Point Aston Martin thing, simply because I would like to see Vettel go out on a bit more of a high, shall we say. And he may yet do, because if he does retire, he's still got this season, such as it is, to come. So you never know. But he's a very good driver. And, you know, we saw what he did in the Red Bull days, which were remarkable performances at times, when he's at his best. He's an absolutely wonderful driver. But yeah, it's hard to see him having the desire to do that, really, isn't it? I mean, connected to Vettel, we would have to say that by status, if Renault, which now has a vacancy alongside Esteban Ocon for next year now that Ricciardo's gone, if they're looking for a high-status driver, then Vettel is one of the ones who is on the market. So would you be looking at Vettel if you were Renault, Scott?
You'd have to look at him, but I think I wouldn't hold out hope of getting him, because I think Ricciardo's already given you a massive vote of no confidence. So that sends a really, really bleak message to other big-name drivers. And Abitbol has already talked about the fact that just because they're a works team, they can't keep relying on the promise and the prestige and everything that comes with that to convince drivers, because eventually reality sets in and a driver won't look at it as, well, this is the works team, this has got serious investment, this has got all the right pieces in place, so this is a great project to join. They will just look at it and say, well, there's a mountain of evidence now that suggests that this isn't a project that's going to succeed. It's a woefully underperforming organization that's not reaching its true potential. And I think the fact that Abitbol was so dismissive of Ricciardo in the very I don't even know what the word is to describe the statement they put out.
I think the word might be graceless, Scott.
It was, yeah, it was. And I actually think it was, I think it was quite petty, to be honest, to bring loyalty into it, because I made a sort of slightly flippant comment on Twitter about the way that Renault didn't really care for all of the loyalty that they're talking about when it came to flicking, whether it was Magnussen or Palmer or Sainz or Hülkenberg. And that's not to say that Renault was wrong to get rid of those drivers, but it's just whether your team or driver, there comes a point where you need to make a decision that is in your best interest. And loyalty is all well and good, and even in a heartless world like Formula One, there is a place for loyalty. But loyalty doesn't mean committing sort of career suicide or hurting your own prospects significantly just for the sake of sentiment. And Renault would never have been expected to keep someone like Julian Palmer on their books when he was underperforming compared to Hülkenberg. Likewise, when a driver like Ricciardo becomes available, okay, it's all well and good that Sainz has done a really good job there alongside Hülkenberg, but ultimately you can only keep one of those drivers because a better driver is available. So loyalty doesn't come into play there. You get rid of Sainz because Ricciardo's better. And Ricciardo's now in the position that Renault's been in with its drivers over the last few years. He's got a choice to make. Do I stick with one team that's not given me what it promised it would give me last year and see out my contract? He's not trying to bail out early or anything like that. He's adhering, he's sticking to his side of the bargain. Renault hasn't stuck to theirs, so now he's looking at what he can do to further his prospects. He's completely entitled to do that.
The one benefit for Renault is they have got rid of a $25 million a year spend on a driver. So when it comes to looking at candidates, Vettel would be relatively big ticket in terms of cost. Fernando Alonso, who's on the market, of course, had his success, world championship successes with Renault. He'd also be a high value item. But Mark, where do you think Renault's at in terms of what it's willing to spend on drivers, given that there are some credible options out there that would do a good job, who would be the kind of the pound world option, should we say, who we know would do a good job, but you wouldn't be spending a huge amount of money on to show that your car isn't actually that good?
Yeah, I think the world is the world globally in terms of economics is very different now to when Daniel and Renault did that deal. I don't think you would get that deal now if we rerun those circumstances now. So I don't think even an Alonso or a Vettel would be able to command that sort of salary that Daniel was able to command 2 years ago. I think the possibility of Fernando coming back is very real. He wants to come back. Wouldn't say desperate because that suggests the wrong tone, but he would very, very much like to be back. And even though we've talked about the limitations, the apparent limitations of the team, he probably figures he just being on the grid at all would be his route back in to get himself further up the grid, either with that team or with another team subsequently. I think his deal, I'm not expecting anything imminent from Renault on driver announcement at who's going to be replacing Ricciardo. And I think if it is Alonso, it would be a complicated deal because essentially it will involve him bringing the sponsors along with him that would effectively be paying his salary. And if they can pull that off, that's got to be a very, very attractive deal for Renault, because even though driver salaries aren't included in the budget cap, you're still having to spend them. So you're still having to spend that money for the big money drivers. So if you could get a Fernando Alonso for a net small number or even a neutral number, but he can bring the sponsors with him that would pay him, then that's got to be a real attractive proposition to Renault.
Yeah, it's clear that cost is on Cyril Abitbol's mind, because he's been fairly open about F1 needing to do something to control the spending of teams on drivers, whereas of course he was the one who did the $25 million deals for a year for Ricciardo. So, you know, there's one quite simple solution to that, which is don't do the big money deals if you don't want to pay your drivers that much. And although you get what you pay for, there are, Scott, some very, very good options and possibilities out there. So I wouldn't say Renault's in a bad position, because it's the kind of best realistically available seat. Because, and I say that because I can't imagine Mercedes are going to change. They might. I don't know for certain that they won't, but I'd be very surprised if they change. I'd be surprised if Red Bull goes outside of its closed shop, its closed loop Red Bull driver. So you have got a manufacturer team that is towards the front of the midfield, at least. So that's quite appealing. You've basically got your pick of the drivers as the cascade effect of Vettel continues to be felt, haven't you?
It's a nice route back into Formula One for the jilted ex-Renault driver Nico Hülkenberg, isn't it? I'm sure he's quite keen to come back to F1, but he doesn't want to come back just to make the numbers up. So if he thought that Renault had made progress since he was ousted for Esteban Ocon, then maybe he'd be willing to go back there. It depends on whether or not he left on good terms. I would imagine he left on slightly better terms than Ricciardo's going to leave, based on that abitable statement. But there are other drivers. There'll be the youngsters outside of Formula One on Renault's books that will be seeing this as an opportunity to get their big break. I'd say Guan Yu Zhou and Christian Lundgaard are probably the two guys at the head of the queue there. But this, Ed, seems like a really perfect opportunity for you to make your state-mandated Sergio Perez pitch, doesn't it?
It'd be a very good option. I just like Perez because I don't think he's going to be taking dominant world championship victories or anything, but he's experienced, he's a great operator, he fits in really well. And, you know, for a team that may well benefit from having some money in, he's a good option. If you're Perez, I would imagine you'd want to stay with Racing Point, which is becoming Aston Martin, but Renault have tried to get Perez before. A lot of teams have in that part of the grid. And, you know, they do well to at least have a channel open. I'm sure they will do to him, because you know what you can get. You know, Renault are a midfield team, so who better to sign than the king of the midfield?
Yeah, I mean, the reason I mentioned Perez is because you've made this argument before that a team like Racing Point, that's morphing into Aston Martin and has the money of Lawrence Stroll and his wealthy associates behind it, what better statement of intent for Aston Martin to make than to have Sebastian Vettel in the team for their push in Formula One from next season? And let's be realistic. Lawrence isn't going to sack his son, is he? So if you're going to
I don't know about that, because if Lawrence Stroll wants to be taken seriously as someone who wants that team to succeed, if Lance does not unlock the underlying potential, and there is potential there, he's going to have no choice. Otherwise, I can't take that team seriously, because if they want to do what they've got to do, you've got to have the two drivers who can do it. Stroll might evolve into that, but he's got to show that he can.
Yeah, but I agree, but that hasn't stopped Lawrence putting him in the car up to now, has it? So I don't think that really changes it, as long as he thinks he's got one guy in the car, in the other car, that's actually going to do the business. And I just think if you're going to have to try and awkwardly extract one of those guys from the team, Perez has got a contract there to 22, I think, or maybe is it only until next year? I can't remember off the top of my head. But Perez, I can just see them trying to sort of move Perez aside to get Vettel in. And if that happens, then Renault would be stupid not to go for him. But obviously that's just totally hypothetical.
Well, I think Racing Point could get a lot out of Vettel. I think they're a great racing team. They work really well. And so, yeah, they should look at someone like Vettel. But, and it does show that there's still potential for some other unexpected effects in the driver market to have an impact. And Renault, I guess, is probably the next domino to fall, because I don't really see Mercedes necessarily as being a part of it. I mean, obviously, Toto Wolff's made some polite noises about Sebastian Vettel. I think he said, worst the effect of, well, when a driver like that becomes available, yeah, that does change a driver market. But I think that was more out of just decency rather than saying, no, we're not interested. Red Bull have sort of suggested they're not interested or couldn't afford Vettel anyway. So, but you never know. These things, the driver market's a very unstable kind of thing, and you're waiting on the whims and the decisions of individuals. And, you know, we can put ourselves in their places, but different people's priorities and thought processes vary. Do you think there'll be any shocks, Mark?
I would just put in a little proviso that let's assume we get this season up and running, and let's assume that Alex Albon doesn't do what we all hope he will do and be a genuine front runner. And let's just suppose he struggles and they get to the end of this season and he's not got any closer to Max than he did last season. What does Red Bull do at that point? Does it just plug in another junior driver? But they seem to be running out of them, or certainly running out of ones that they haven't already tried. Or do they?
They could sign Sergio Perez.
They could do that, but yeah.
Or, my answer to everything.
Or do they do a low price deal with Seb and plug in the known performance of Seb?
Yeah, it's difficult with Verstappen like that, because I think Verstappen would be fairly confident he could still lead the team. But with that, for a team that's really had to focus on building itself around Verstappen, would bringing in the old Red Bull stager and a driver who would see himself as reclaiming that team as his be a safe and sensible move? I don't know. I mean, I'm definitely not ruling it out, because anything is possible.
Yeah, and I don't think Seb would, under those circumstances, necessarily see it as reclaiming his team. I think you might just see it as a way of showing that he was still very, very high level driver and able to fight for wins.
And I don't know what you think. I don't know what you think, Mark, but I suspect as well that having seen off someone like Ricciardo and then seen what Leclerc's done to Vettel at Ferrari, I would imagine that Max would be pretty confident he's got Seb's number as well. So he wouldn't necessarily feel totally threatened by it, and therefore he wouldn't get sucked into to being disrupted or performing at a worse level.
Yeah, I could see it work, and I don't think it's going to pan out that way. I would hope that Alex is really going to do what's required to make that drive his own. But if it doesn't, I wouldn't rule it out.
Well, there will need to be some creative thinking from Red Bull if that happens, certainly. So yeah, it's possible.
One of the things I just wanted to add to that is I remember in Japan last year speaking to someone high up at Red Bull about the prospect of getting Seb back in, and this was obviously at a time when Verstappen's future wasn't nailed down. They'd managed to keep him for 2020 because of that strong first half of the year, and I think he was third in the championship, wasn't he, going into the summer break. But there was a question mark about Max's long-term commitment, and Red Bull's position was basically that if Max left, then they were quite confident that they'd be able to get Seb back, and that they'd want to have Seb back. They're on great terms with him, so it would work. But the reason that they wouldn't have the two of them together, it's partly financial. They don't want to fund two megastars, but also they don't want two alpha drivers in the same team, and that is what Seb and Max would be. And now they've got Max on that long-term deal, and Red Bull has sort of set its stall out quite emphatically, hasn't it, that this is Max Verstappen plus one, and that plus one just needs to be good enough to do the job. So I guess it would depend on whether, if Alex, as you say, Mark, I really hope Alex does step up and become that driver. If not, my suspicion is that Red Bull would maybe entertain the idea of Vettel coming back, but would ultimately settle for giving Gasly another try. I can't imagine they'd go back to Kvyat, but as Mark sort of said, they've basically run themselves out of options.
It does showcase the fact that Vettel's mindset keeps coming up. The real question there is really what's going on inside his head, and we don't know if he thinks, actually, I've had enough of this, I want to go and focus on other things in life. He's got three kids, I think, now, so he's got lots going on away from Formula One. Does he have that desire to still win world championships and be a lead driver in a top team, or is it, as you suggest, Mark, I want to just go in and show I can still do it a little bit and go out on slightly different terms, and just, you know, winning some races in a Red Bull would probably serve that purpose, even if he couldn't bother Max Verstappen over the season? And does he have the appetite for a long-term midfield project, which is what something like Renault or the Racing Point Aston Martin thing would do? So interesting, isn't it? We'll just have to wait to see what Seb decides to do. Anyway, I mean, I think me and Scott in our recent podcast thought most likely he would end up retiring, but that wasn't kind of a 100% prediction. That was a balance of probability. Maybe that will happen. What would you put your money on if you had to, Mark? Oh, unfortunately, Mark has just lost internet just as asking that question. Well, I know what we think. But overall, Scott, I think we can agree this is quite exciting for Formula One for 21, isn't it? We thought the driver market might be a bit stagnant. Vettel's decision has had a big impact. And I think it's great to have drivers moving around, isn't it? Because it just makes for great storylines, puts different drivers up against each other in the same team, and just freshens everything up, doesn't it?
Oh, it really does. The amount of movement is fascinating. I'm just sort of just having a little look, really, at the way the grid's changed since, like, even 2019, 2018. Like, we haven't gone racing in 2020. By the time we go racing in 2021, Renault will have a totally different lineup to what they had in 2019. One of the McLaren drivers has moved on. One of the Ferrari drivers has moved on. Who knows if Kimi Raikkonen will still be kicking around at Alfa Romeo, but he'll still be there. Obviously, the Red Bull saga, you've had a driver come in, get flicked halfway through the season, and then go back to AlphaTauri. It's been the constant through it all has been Mercedes, Lewis Hamilton and Valtteri Bottas over the last few seasons. And it's probably the reason why they're so good and seem unbeatable in title terms. But even if that's not going to change next year, we're still going to have so much to talk about and look forward to. And a new driver coming in at the very, very sharp end, someone like Sainz joining in at Ferrari. And I think, won't Sainz and Leclerc make up what must be the youngest driver lineup in half a century or something for Ferrari? It's a young pairing. They'll be 23 and 26, I think.
Yeah, they had Ickx and Eamon for a time. And two cars for them at times, which was a bit younger. But yeah, it's very rare to go so young.
So it's just great. It's great to see. And then you're going to see the challenge of Ricciardo getting to grips with McLaren and going wheel to wheel with Norris. And is Alonso going to be back on the grid, or is Vettel going to be having a swan song in a midfield team? There's so much to look forward to. And yeah, we've got a bit of a rubbish situation going on at the moment, but I'm optimistic that once we come out the other side, there's still going to be a lot of fun to be had. Let's put it that way.
Yeah. Oh, we. I think we have Mark Hughes back.
I'm back.
Excellent. Well done. Well done. Well, in that case, I'll fire the question that you weren't able to answer a minute ago, which is, what's your best guess, the most probable course of action for Sebastian Vettel?
I think he's going to retire. I think he would like nothing better than to get in a Mercedes or a Red Bull. Ultimately, I don't believe that will happen, and I think he will think of something else to do with his life.
Yeah, I think that's pretty much in line with what myself and Scott have been saying. But I mean, Scott was just saying in general terms, it is good that we're seeing this freshening up for next year, because 21 was threatening to be not a damp squib, because a Grand Prix season never is, but because it's been cast as 2020 part two rather than 21, the big brave new world for F1, there was a little bit of a sense of anticlimax. But having these key driver moves is going to make next season something really to get excited about, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. It always just gives that dynamic quality to a season, doesn't it? When there's a bit of a shuffle in the top seats. I mean, it's all well and good to see the silly season playing out in the midfield, but it's much more exciting when it's one of the top seats. Yeah.
Yeah, well, that Leclerc versus Sainz battle is going to be one to watch. It always changes the dynamic of the team, and I think well-deserved for Carlos Sainz. Well, we should probably finish there, and thanks very much, Mark, for making a heroic late entry just to complete the question that I'd asked. Thanks very much, Scott Mitchell, as well. I think Scott's still here, but he's just frozen on my screen with a slightly smug look on his face, so I'm not quite sure what's going on there. But anyway, we don't need to hear from him. Do check out thedriver.therace.com, and don't forget the hyphen. We've all been writing all sorts of stuff about the driver market on there, delving into lots of the themes we've talked about here and many others as well. And of course, we've got eSport coverage on there, IndyCar as well as F1. There's loads for you to read on there. Check out our YouTube channel as well. If you search for The Race there, you'll find loads of videos, including one having a look at the reasons why Ferrari signed Carlos Sainz. And also, do subscribe to some of our other podcasts as well. The Gary Anderson F1 show comes out every week. We've got an episode out with him talking about the Vettel Ferrari situation at the moment. We've got Bring Back V10s, which tells classic F1 stories, an eSport podcast, MotoGP podcast as well. So thanks very much. I won't sign off with a stay home, stay safe, because the rules are changing a bit. But all I will say is please join us next time on the Race F1 podcast.